Hi, I'm Guy Powell, and welcome to the next episode of the Backstory on Marketing, as well as the Backstory on the Shroud. I'm going to publish this one on two of my podcasts. And if you haven't already done so, please visit guypowell.com and sign up for all of these episodes and podcasts. And I am the author of two newly released books. One is The Post-COVID Marketing Machine, and the other one is The Only Witness, which is a Christian historical fiction on the Shroud of Turin, which is Jesus Christ's burial cloth. And again, you can find more information about that on guypowell.com. So this year is a very special year. It is the 15th anniversary of the Miracle on the Hudson. And this is when there was a flight that actually landed on the Hudson, United Flight 1549. And really, due to miraculous efforts of Captain Sully Sullenberger, amazingly, all lives were saved. And today we're with Vallie Collins. She is one of the survivors of from that fateful flight. She was in seat 26D, so way in the back of the plane, and I guess it was the last row. And but you were on the aisle, so that was
on the aisle.
It's even worse when you're sitting next to the engine. That's right. So Vallie, it's so good to have you today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. I'm going to correct you real quick. U.S. Airways, not United. Just because United might get, U.S. Airways. Just U.S. Airways 1549.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. U.S. Airways Flight 1549. All right. So anyway, you recommended a book for me, and I'm about halfway through it. It's awesome. It's really fascinating to,
good,
you know, to read and what happens and everything. Yeah. And I just can't fathom, you know, what you guys went through. But as I was thinking about it, there's kind of like four time periods that are really critical. There's kind of like right after the bird strike.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's right after the landing, or the landing, I guess, and then immediately thereafter. And then, of course, there's the rescue, the miraculous rescue. And then there's the rest of your life.
That's right.
So tell us about yourself. Tell us about a little bit about what happened. And I'm going to let you free talk for a little bit.
Okay. Well, I'm a free talker. So just throw the yellow flag at me if you need me to stop. But my name is Vallie Collins. I live in East Tennessee, just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm married to my husband, Steve. We'll celebrate 26 years here in a couple of months. We've got three children, a daughter, two sons. They range in age from 25 to 19. So I'm a new empty nester as of August. So getting used to not having as much chaos in my house and trying to find the good spots of that, even though sometimes it kind of makes me sad. I'm pretty much a Tennessee girl through and through. I've lived in Tennessee most of my life, a stint in Texas, Mississippi, and Arkansas, but I am a Southern girl for sure. I graduated from the University of Tennessee with a degree in biomedical engineering. I started my career in that field in the quality assurance manufacturing side of medical devices, and then transitioned to the sales side and did the sales deal for about 13 years. I was in the industry for about 20. So in sales, my company was based in Minnesota, but I had a home office in Tennessee back, you know, when nobody worked remote. We were working remote in 2000. So but part of the requirement of the job is I traveled a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So early January 14th of 2009, I flew up to New York for a meeting out on Long Island the morning of January 15th. Just a one-night regular sales trip that I'd done, you know, hundreds of times. And that afternoon of January 15th, I found myself on board U.S. Airways 1549 that was headed from LaGuardia to Charlotte. Any problem?
Yeah.
Okay. So I get asked about the flight and kind of if you kind of break it down into the four parts, as you said, I was on the last row and, you know, I get asked the question, was there anything odd, anything usual? Not a lot. The only thing is I remember before I sat down in my seat, there was a baby blue baby blanket draped across the back of my seat. And I remember thinking, well, that's a little strange. Yeah. So I grabbed the blanket. I gave it to the flight attendant who's in the galley. Beyond her, I see a mom with this baby. And I remember thinking, well, there's the rightful owner. I sat down in my seat, had a little bit of a conversation with the guy at the window. No one was yet in the middle seat. And it was kind of that, who's going to be the person that's going to come sit, you know, in this middle seat, that dread, even though, because they're telling us it's a full flight, we're behind schedule. I'm chatting with the guy at the window. We kind of figure out he's into hang gliding, so he always gets a window seat. I like an aisle seat. I like to get out, you know, so mm-hmm. we're kind of happy with our seat location. They closed the front boarding door. We started backing away from the gate.
And that's when there's joy.
That's when there's joy because, number one, we're leaving because we were late. And there had been weather in the New York area that morning. It had moved out. So I was just glad that, all right, I'm going to make my connection in Charlotte because I was going to connect from Charlotte on to Knoxville. And we're backing away from the gate finally. And no one's come to sit in the middle seat. So I literally looked at my seatmate, and we hadn't exchanged names, but we'd been chatting, and I was like, well, this is going to be our lucky day. Look how lucky we are. We got all this elbow room to Charlotte. Well, little did I know how true those words would be in less than, 10 minutes. I am asked a lot of times, well, why did y'all have this empty seat? There was 155 people on board. It's a completely full flight, and that's because that baby counted as a passenger.
Mm.
So with airlines, with planes, you can only have so many souls on board. It's not so many how many people are in the seats. It's how many lives are on board. So that's why we lucked out, if you will, and had the empty middle seat. Not too long after takeoff, maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes, about 2,800 feet was our altitude. We heard this boom. So part two, the birds hit.
Yep.
And it was a loud noise. The plane sort of dropped a little bit. I looked at my seatmate because I knew he was looking out the window. He told me. I looked out the window. I was like, what is that?
And you never heard that before.
Never heard that before. Yeah. It was just, and sitting in the last row of the plane, so I'm behind the engines, and you've been on lots of flights. In that phase of a flight, you're hearing full thrust, a lot of engine noise. You're climbing. Well, all of a sudden, it's just this boom, boom, boom. I tell people sometimes it's like tennis balls in a dryer. It just boom, 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 and then just stopped. And then I looked to my left and I smelled smoke and this awful odor. I didn't see like flames of fire. You just smelled like it was burning goose flesh is what it was, where the birds had gotten sucked into the engines. And at that point, I knew it was a pretty serious situation because about 10 years before, I'd been on a turbulent flight and there was a pilot who had leaned over at because he could tell I was nervous. I was a little scared. And he told me, he's like, don't worry about turbulence. He said, all we worry about up front are birds and fire. So I really had that thought of, okay, we've got both, birds and fire. This is not good. So very early on, I knew it was a pretty, pretty dire situation. The flight attendant came up from the back. She tried to get something from behind my seat. I thought it was maybe a fire extinguisher. So I got out of the seat to grant her access and ask her if she needed help. And she said, no, but she told me she wanted me to sit back down. But she told me to sit in that empty middle seat in case she needed the aisle. So I started in 26D, but I landed in 26E. So I'm probably the only passenger on board that could claim two seat locations, but I buckled up.
Well, you were just borrowing it from the baby.
That's right. I was just borrowing it from the baby. I buckled up as you would. I looked at my seatmate and I was just in such shock. I looked at him and I said, I have three children to raise. Kind of that, this cannot be happening. I have three kids to go home. I joked, but like nobody else on board had anything to live for.
Right.
But, And he's a man of faith. I remember, and I shouldn't say that, but I do remember when we boarded, he had one of those rubber bracelets on that had the WWJD.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and he said, I have a daughter and I'm going to see her tonight. Well, I so wanted to believe him. I thought, he's got faith that this is, but I really didn't believe him.
But did you have faith in Christ at that moment or?
For sure. I had accepted the Lord in my heart a long time ago. At that particular moment, it was more of, I can't believe this is happening, Lord. Time sort of stood still a little bit and you start processing, this is probably not going to end well. We don't, and my seatmate, when Sullenberger, in hindsight, when Sullenberger turned us to line up with the Hudson River, that's when I was sort of out of my seat. So when I sat back down, my seatmate, he also said, he's turned us back towards LaGuardia. We're going back to the airport because that's what it felt like, even though that's not what was happening. But it was a surreal moment. I do remember thinking, well, Lord, if this is your will, I accept it.
Mm-hmm.
but I'm not real crazy about it. I'm pretty sad about it because I'm going to miss, you know,
right.
My children were 9, 6, and 4 on that day.
Well, and plus you still have, you know, you're still, it hasn't happened yet. You haven't landed or been ditched yet. So,
and I'm not, at that point, I'm not even thinking landing, ditching. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking we're going to crash.
Yeah.
Like this is, you know, we're over one of the most densely populated areas of the country, you know, New York City. I'm not even thinking, oh, he's going to land. And so you're all in your thought. I'm all in my thoughts. I'm in my, okay, if I am going to die, at that point, 3 of my 4 grandparents were still alive. I had one grandfather pass away. He was a very strong man of faith. And I thought, well, Daddy Smitty's going to be there waiting on me. You know, he'll be at the pearly gates and we'll play around the golf or whatever you get to do in heaven. But I remember just seeing his face thinking, well, okay. So there was, I guess, a moment, you know, of acceptance. But in about that same moment was when you're kind of snapped back to reality. And I hear Captain Sullenberger come over the PA system. And he just says, this is the captain, brace for impact.
That must have caused a shudder.
That gets your attention.
Yeah.
You know, that you can brace for impact. And then my seatmate, who's still looking out the window, so I'm, you know, brace for impact. I'm bent over. I've read the safety card. I'm folded over like a sandwich with my arms underneath my legs. And my seatmate says, he's still looking out the window, mind you. And he said, be ready. We're going in the water. And then I thought, I guess that's the kind of type A engineer in me brain turns on. And I'm thinking, okay, airplane water landing. Most likely, we're going cartwheel. Plane's going to bust and do a lot of different pieces. So, Valley, if you're conscious, swim to the light. And that's what I told myself. Just swim to the light. And when I speak, I tell audiences, you know, I think this is an example of one of those times where, like, mentally, what we get ourselves prepared for has a whole lot to do with how well we accept the reality of the situation when it occurs. Because mentally, I got very prepared for the very worst.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't sudden is the worst thing, I think. Because you still have seconds or whatever it is to wait on whatever's going to happen.
Right. You know, from the time that the birds knocked out the engines to the time we landed on the Hudson River was right at 3.5 minutes.
Mm.
And, you know, you think 3.5 minutes, that seems so fast. But I would challenge people, take 3.5 minutes and do nothing except think, this is my last living moments. And it's a long, long time. Oddly enough, my middle son, we went to a Christian retreat quite a few years back in California. And it was kind of a, you know, it's a bonding parent-child kind of type thing. And one of the exercises was to sit on a log, face each other, and look in the other person's eye for 3 minutes and not look away. And it's sobering how long 3 minutes can be. And even for my son, who was, I think he was only 16 at the time, he, you know, afterwards he was like, Mom, I mean, it was that long that you kind of, jokingly, I'll tell people, you know, 3.5 minutes, that's a commercial break. You can go to the bathroom, pop some popcorn.
Right,
I mean, so I'm going, went off on a little bit of a tangent there, but it's a fair amount of time that you have to think about it. And I think that time, and for me personally, the awareness, how early I realized we had a problem, I think that's a direct line or correlation to kind of the post-traumatic stress, the after effects, is how long versus I've been in a car accident before and, you know, just boom, hits you out of nowhere. I mean, like, you don't have any time to prep for it. It happens so quickly. We had a lot of mental time.
So, and plus you're in the back of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably also thinking, well, do I go out the front way or do I go backwards or?
Yeah. Yeah. So when we landed, after we hit the river and landed and seemingly stopped, we never really stopped because there's a current, you know, with the river. I knew, okay, I'm on the last row. The closest exit, you know, is behind me. So I immediately go to that rear galley. I did not think about going forward at all. I immediately thought closest exit is the back. I had the conscious thought of leaving my purse, leaving my belongings. You know, I thought I need both arms to get all that can be replaced. I do remember having that thought. And then when I got to the rear galley, I was the first passenger back there. And the flight attendant, she doesn't realize we're in the water at this point. Hmm. She's trying to crack open the left rear door. Well, I went over and tried to help her do that, but we're not going to get the door open. The water pressure outside is so much stronger,
right,
you know, than she
right.
and I are.
Right.
And then she looks around. She says, oh, no, we're in the water. And she said, go to the wings. You have 2 minutes. And so she moved forward towards the wings. More passengers are in the rear galley. They're trying to get the left rear door open. It won't open either. And really, God, this is where I probably had my scariest moment, because in a matter of seconds, the water went from my ankles to above my chest. And it was 35 degree water.
Cold.
Cold, like Titanic cold. Needles in your body, cold. And up to that point, one of my biggest irrational fears had always been being in a car going over a bridge that went off the bridge, and your car was going underwater and you were trapped and you couldn't get out. Well, here I found myself in this airplane galley filling with water and nowhere seemingly to go. I mean, people in front of me are trying to come to the back as well, thinking closest exit is the back. And I'm 100% sure we're not getting out the back.
Yep.
The back is sinking. So I just put up my hands and told people, like, go to the wings, start moving to the wings, just as loud a voice, Southern voice I can muster. And people started to hear me and they turned and we moved towards the wings.
So one of the things that, as I was reading the book, and I also just watched the movie Sully.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that really I thought about was leadership in a crisis. And, you know, so you have certainly Sullenberger, he's sitting up there, you know, brace for impact. And then you have the flight attendants there saying brace, brace, brace. And I can't remember what the rest of it is. I'm sure you know that perfectly, but brace, brace, brace. And then, but to get off, to take then the chaos, which I would imagine took place, and then they had the lead, because they're really in, at that point, they're kind of in charge of chaos.
It's chaos. I mean, I tell people, you know how chaotic was, you're trying to get off an airplane that's parked at the gate.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, it's Sully. I love the movie Sully. I thought it was great. I tell Tom Hanks could read the phone book and I would be entertained. Of course, we don't even have phone books anymore. But back when we did, but the evacuation scene in the movie didn't really line up with reality. They got it pretty calm in there. They're like, here, have a blanket. It's cold out there. So that's kind of the Hollywood version of the evacuation scene, because it was chaotic. People are in shock.
If you're up to your neck and the water's rising,
you know, now we know that when we landed on the river, that Sullenberger, and rightly so, put the tail of the airplane came down first, just like the way you land on a runway. So the APU, the auxiliary power unit, fell off the tail of the plane.
Hmm.
So there was a big hole right underneath that rear galley where all the water was rushing in. You know, there was a little bit debate. Well, cracking open the rear doors, did that create the water? And I don't think it did.
Yeah.
I think it's the big hole where the APU fell off that created all the water. So, yeah, you're just trying to, there was that surreal moment. And I remember thinking, oh Lord, please do not let me drown. Like, I do not want to drown. Kind of this moment of, okay, this plane is landing in the river. It's in one piece. And I didn't even know it was a river. We could have been in the Atlantic Ocean for all I knew. Like, I didn't know I'm in the Hudson River. There was just this, you know, I didn't know where I was, or the East River, or where we are. But there was this, wow, the plane held together. I'm still alive. Didn't think I would still be alive. And now I'm going to drown in this galley. You know, this is, I just remember thinking, Lord, please don't let me drown. And I had this peace. I had this real calm come over me. And I instinctively knew that panicking was not going to save my life.
Isn't that amazing?
It was literally like a wave.
Yep.
For no pun intended, but it was like a wave of water coming over me and just going, don't panic, stay calm. And I've read things from psychologists and been interviewed, and they say in those type of situations, from a lead back to your point about leadership, about 70% of people will stay calm in a crisis, and they'll do, and then about 30% will kind of freak out, lose it. And that's probably, I wasn't doing a head count, but that's probably what I saw. I mean, I saw some people really lose it, but then I saw people come alongside and shepherd them and help them, you know, make it to an exit. I tell people, Sullenberger, he'll say this too. He did such a fantastic job, he and Officer Skiles, of landing the plane in the river. But it really took that collective effort of the passengers, the crew, the first responders, the civilians that came on boats for us all to survive.
So you had to, though, you had to walk or whatever, swim, tread water to get up like 13 rows roughly to get up to the exit row.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't ever remember my feet leaving the floor, you know, and as I started walking towards the wings, it was like walking uphill. Yeah. And as you walked uphill, the water started to subside. Mm-hmm. I did grab a seat cushion that was floating by. I put it on my right arm. I never had a life jacket, but I did get a seat cushion. And when I got to probably around row 15 or 16, that's when I could see the light of day, because the over the wing exits were at 10 and 11. And that's what, because it was really dark in the back of the plane as well. Yeah. A lot of the lights and everything went out. It was a cloudy, overcast day, 3:30 in the afternoon. You know, it was pretty dark, pretty dark right there. So once I could see the light of day, I thought, okay, I'm going to make it. I think I'm going to make it. I wasn't relaxed yet, but I could see the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel.
So did you go out the right wing?
Went out the right wing.
You went out the right wing. Where you must have been one of the last ones out then.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about the frog in my throat. Yes, I was one of the last passengers out. So in the infamous picture of us floating, you don't really see me, because probably at the point that was taken, I was still either in the airplane or when I stepped out on the wing, I was really close to the fuselage. I was not a passenger. Yeah. I was way out on the wing.
Yeah, yeah. So what's happened since then? What had, obviously your life had to have changed. I can't imagine that it's not any.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess the demographic of my life hasn't changed. I still live in East Tennessee. I'm still married to a great guy, but thanks to the Lord, I've raised those three children and they seem to be pretty, you know, functioning adults. Mm-hmm. So that part has changed a little bit, but I'm still a person I was in many ways. I was a positive, upbeat extrovert, but I think there is definitely a sense of life purpose and life responsibility. There is this, when you go through something like this, whether it be, you know, a plane landing in a river or a cancer, you know, beating cancer or, you know, some type of personal traumatic experience, especially when you feel like, okay, I maybe skirted death this time. There is this onus, there's responsibility. I've got these extra days that I really did not think that I was going to have. So how do I make the most of those? How do I, you know, how can I be the best version of myself? Although I'm a very different version of myself just because of the post-traumatic stress disorder and the kind of mental toll that something like that takes on you, but there a life responsibility that maybe I didn't appreciate.
So you have a couple of causes that you're working for. Were you working with them prior to the event or only afterwards?
I was serving on a board for our local city schools foundation. So I was starting to do some things like that. You know, honestly, at that season of my life, up into that season of my life, I had been college, getting the career developed, birthing children. You know, I didn't have as much time in my schedule to be able to give back to my community. I'd always been pretty involved with our church and things, but really the boards that I serve on now have come much more after that experience than before. Just that.
So tell us what the causes that you're working with. Tell us about those.
Probably the two that I work the closest with. First is called Love One International. It's based out of Brentwood, Tennessee, so near Nashville. And our purpose, we're a Christian-based organization, but we are a 501c3, is we take care of malnourished babies in Uganda. So we have a center in Gulu, Uganda, where we work with a lot of different districts around Gulu, but many babies are brought to our center, but we also go and do village outreach and bring malnourished children to the centers. We also have an arm of what we do that is home-based care. So children that maybe aren't severely malnourished don't need to necessarily go to the hospital and ultimately come to our center, but maybe through nutritional education with their families and their villages and helping them with the right foods, we can get them back to a healthy state. So most babies that are malnourished that come to our center, they stay there 8 to 12 weeks till we can get them back to the level of healthy, and then we resettle them back with their families. You know, we're not an orphanage. We don't do adoptions. Our whole mission is to rehabilitate those young lives and
stabilize them,
yeah. Get them back. And then we found those children are a true testament in their villages, because they come back healthy, and where they were withering and dying and food and things, they're such scarce resources. So sometimes when babies are dying and a mother doesn't have access to medical care, she doesn't have access to the food, and she's got four other children to feed, she's just at a loss. But then when that child comes back, no longer now malnourished and healthy and thriving, it opens up that conversation of, okay, who is this organization and why did they do that? And what is the, and that's where we're able to, you know, share the word of Christ with them. And
what a way to change their lives, son.
Right. We, you know, our founder, who has been one of my dear friends for about 40 years, it's hard to go out and tell someone who is literally starving about Jesus and his love for them. You know, it's better to, okay, let's show them Jesus' love and show them what love and nutrition and food can do and care. And then it opens that door, that conversation.
Well, it's interesting because that's kind of what the old missionaries would do, is they'd first provide health care, mm-hmm. get the health going and get it back to, you know, like just like you're doing, stabilize them so that they can go back to their families or whatever. And then once that kind of worked on, then it was, you know, get them into education and things like
right.
that. Yeah. So it's more or less it's a missionary activity.
Yeah, it is. And it's also our center. We're in a temporary facility right now. We're building our new center that will, our grand opening is set for June. But all of our staff, we employ about 75 people on the ground, and they're all Ugandan. Mm. So it's also impactful too that we are able to employ people, provide them, you know, a good wage, provide them insurance, hopefully a place to work that they love. And it's allowing them to provide for their families. So it kind of comes full circle. And it's a lot of times we're just so blessed to get to do this. Like how lucky are we? So I go to Uganda a couple times a year, which forces me to get on airplanes for a long time.
How hard is that? That's got to be really hard.
And, you know, it gets easier. Time helps. Those mm-hmm. first 5 years getting mm-hmm. on airplanes, whether it was a 20-minute flight or a 20-hour flight, were tough for me. But my little grandmother, when I was kind of struggling that first year about flying or not flying, she said, well, Valley, if you run into one thing, you'll run into something else. So
well, that's right. True.
Yeah,
that's true.
I'll just keep flying. And
so do you think driving a car is safer than flying a plane?
No. Flying a plane is much. I tell people, a lot of times when I speak, they'll be like, they'll say, what's the most dangerous part of the airplane trip? I'm like, the drive to the airport in your car. You know, that's the most dangerous part of your airplane trip. You know, I think if we all were made aware every day of every mm-hmm. fatality in cars, probably none of us would get in our car. It's just with planes, there's a lot of people at once and everybody hears about it.
Yeah.
So, no, it is statistically definitely the safest way to travel. Yeah. What happened to us, I hope I'm not misquoting this. I believe the NTSB said the likelihood of birds to knock out the engines, both engines of a jetliner, was 1 in 8 billion with a B.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those.
So that is 1 in 8 billion. That's so small that technically it should never happen again.
I mean, you know, and there are 8,000 to 9,000 bird strikes a year on airplanes. Very common, but one engine, you fly back to the airport, no big deal. Yeah. So it's just totally one of those.
Well, I was surprised in the book that I was reading, and that how many bird strikes there are. It's tons.
It's tons. It's a lot. It's very common, but not, and I also think, I don't know that, I think we were 16-pound Labrador geese. I think they were very, very large birds, you know? I think they're used to maybe taking in a sparrow more often, but anyway.
Yeah, well, they're supposed to survive a sparrow or something like that.
Right, I believe I was told General Electric, when they're building those engines, they'll throw like 8-pound frozen turkeys at those engines, you know, but these are like twice the capacity of what they were built to handle. The other board I'm currently serving on is more local, if you will, in my county where I live in Tennessee, Blount County, but it's New Hope Children's Advocacy. So we are a center that helps abused children, whether it be, you know, physically, sexually. It's a place for them to come tell their story one time. And we have forensic interviewers. We have all the video equipment. Mm-hmm. We have the district attorney. We have the police, everybody they can get the medical exam one time. So that child, years ago, there was a little girl in Alabama who had been abused. And by the time she got to the courtroom, she looked at the judge and she goes, "Why have I had to say this six or seven times?" Because by the time she told,
right.
But you know,
right.
So that's what our advocacy center does, is for those children to be able to come tell what happened to them. Hopefully prosecute their offender. And then we also offer therapy services after the fact to rehabilitate that child and their family.
And that's got, I imagine that's a long process.
It's a long, painful process. And, you know, we want to work ourselves out of a job. But sadly things still happen. But so I think children and things for children are definitely a common theme.
Yeah, that's for sure.
In the work that I do, I work with the City Schools Foundation with our schools. Okay. So kind of have a heart for kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's wonderful. Well, Valley, thank you so much. Very interesting. Is there anything else you'd like to mention that we haven't talked about?
No, I don't think so. I just, you know, I tell people every day's a lucky day. So just try to live it to the fullest.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that's probably very different than before.
Oh, for sure. The perspective that I have after this experience is just that you can't put a price tag on it.
So how do you like telling your story? Is that now still something that adds and gets your message across about that? Or
yeah, I do. I enjoy telling my story. You know, I never flew U.S. Airways. Like, that was my first flight with them in 5 years. I was a platinum on Delta. But it was $800 less ticket. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I'm on the last row. And so for a lot, well, there are other people on board our flight that took that flight every week. You know, that was just part of their life. So for me, I started like, why was I even there? It was so random happenstance that would be the flight that I was on. And a lot for a while, I struggled like, why was I there? What was I supposed to take away from that? What was I supposed to learn? So when speaking to audiences, for me, I'm like, if one person takes one thing away and does something better in their life, maybe that's why I was there.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
But that's what helps me sort of try to figure out. I like to, you know, solve equations, solve puzzles. I'm a type A type. I like to know the answer. but so telling my story, as long as people want to hear it, you know, this wasn't something I set out to do. I got asked once, and then it just sort of snowballed from there. And if I never tell it again, that's okay. But if I tell it 400 more times, that's great too.
Absolutely. Well, I like your message too of if just one person learns something, because I use that as well. Just one,
right.
Just one.
Right.
And that's a huge, that's very hard to do.
Very hard to do.
And yet, you know, you get one and then you can get another, and then maybe they'll actually, you know, convert other or, you know, affect others as well.
Right. Or share. And, you know, they're little kind of like, they call them God winks, if you will. You know, sometimes I've gotten done speaking and I'll be like, anybody have any questions? And nobody will ask a question. Everybody's bashful. And I'll be getting ready to leave. And, you know, the 6'3" Marine comes up with tears in his eyes and says, "Thank you for talking about PTSD, you know, or, I mean, so it's those kind of little moments. I'm like, okay, well, then maybe there is some purpose.
Yeah.
Some meaning to it.
I'm sure there is. There has to be. Well, there is. Absolutely. Valley, thank you so much. It's been very interesting, and what a story. And I hope then, you know, the same thing that, you know, listeners on my podcast will get the same kind of inspiration out of what you have to say. And again, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So this is Guy Powell, and feel free to visit guypowell.com if you'd like to learn more about my podcasts and then also about Valley. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.